Okay, we'll probably have a few stragglers, but I'll go ahead and begin the introduction. I'll try to keep it relatively brief. It's a real pleasure to have Jim Surmeyer visiting us today. And he's going to talk to us today about striatal adaptations in Parkinson's disease. It's not just about dopamine, which is something, of course, of great interest to members of my laboratory as well as a lot of NIH investigators. Jim originally got his first set of degrees in psychology and mathematics, and as I understand it, he has a lot of formal training in statistics, and that shows up in many of his papers, actually, because he's quite rigorous in statistical analysis of his data, which is something I've always appreciated about his work. He then went on to get a master's in mathematics and then got interested in neuroscience and did his graduate training at the University of Washington. He then went on to do a first postdoctoral fellowship with Bill Willis, where he worked on sensory physiology and including some in vivo monkey recordings, and then moved to the University of Tennessee at Memphis, the Health Sciences Center, where he began his long-term affiliation with that institution, starting with work with Steve Kitai, and then moving on to the faculty and his own independent research. And it's really then that I became aware of Jim's work when he started to do a lot of in-depth characterization of ion channels involved in the excitability of medium spiny neurons in the striatum, and also the modulation of these channels by dopamine receptors, muscarinic acetylcholine receptors, and a variety of other receptors. And that's really been, I think, the seminal work in our understanding of how these neurons work and how they're altered by local neurotransmitters. Since then, Jim was lured away to Northwestern University to be the chair of physiology and has built a really nice group there and has expanded his work to include more cellular imaging and, in addition, has now sort of moved into the area of synaptic plasticity in striatum, something that's very near and dear to my heart, and he's really made some great contributions over the last couple of years in that area as well. So I think it's a real pleasure to have Jim here today, and I'll let him get on with his talk.
Well, I want to thank David. I should probably turn this off. David, for the invitation. It's a real pleasure to be here. You've blown my cover, dude. I mean, now every time in a paper review or a grant review, I say you use the wrong statistical test, they'll know who it was who did the review. So I've had a great morning, lots of terrific people here, obviously. It's a wonderful place to do neuroscience, a wonderful place to be away from the pay lines that we're all enduring in the extramural world. But that hopefully will be a thing of the past and not too distant future. And it's going to be a lot of fun for me to be able to share some of the work that we've been doing over the last few years on striatal plasticity. So let me start by giving you an outline, tell you what I'm going to try and convince you of. All right? There are about 4 points that I want to try and make. The first is that dopamine depletion, which mimics the Parkinsonian state, right, where Parkinson's disease is caused by the degeneration of dopaminergic neurons in the substantia nigra pars compacta, which innervate largely the striatum, not exclusively, but largely the striatum. So the loss of that dopaminergic innervation of the striatum leads to a very rapid and selective loss of glutamatergic synapses on one subpopulation of principal neuron, medium spiny neuron in the striatum, the striatopallidal neurons. It's exclusively of the corticostriatal connectivity, glutamatergic synapses, and not on the thalamic connections of these neurons. The striatopallidal neurons are major parts of the so-called indirect pathway of the basal ganglia, and it's in that pathway where almost all of the pathophysiology that's been described in Parkinsonian patients occurs. Okay? So things like deep brain stimulation target the indirect pathway, and we think that pathophysiology originates in with a, this dysfunction of the striatopalatal neurons and the loss of cortical connectivity of those neurons. And I'm going to show you the evidence for that. Second point I want to try and make goes to the mechanism underlying the loss of connectivity. That loss of connectivity is dependent upon activation of a voltage-dependent calcium channel, which is positioned right at the synapse, the synapses that are lost in the spine head on those glutamatergic synapses in the medium spine neurons. It's a very peculiar type of L-type calcium channel, which has a CAV1.3 subunit. It's a low-threshold L-type calcium channel. For those of you who know something about voltage-dependent calcium channels and neuronal function, you'll recognize the fact that L-type calcium channels often have a very privileged linkage to the transcriptional and translational machinery of neurons are linked to plasticity. Long-term depression, for example, at this very synapse, David shown some time ago, is completely dependent upon L-type calcium channels. And we think that these channels are also involved in the collapse and pruning of spines and synapses following dopamine depletion. Now, the increased opening of those channels, we think, is in part a reflection of simply the loss of dopamine and the loss of activation of D2 dopamine receptors, which are expressed by the striatopalatal neurons. And I don't see Chip here, but striatopalatal and striatonigral neurons are differentiated not only in terms of where they project their axons, but in terms of their expression of dopamine receptors. So the cells that lose their synapses express D2 dopamine receptors largely, and the cells that don't lose their synapses express D1 receptors. And we think the loss of that D2 receptor tone is part of the explanation for their loss of cortical connectivity. But it's only part of the story. And in the last third of the talk, I'm going to talk about what to clinicians has probably been one of the most central players in Parkinson's disease since they began pharmacologically treating it. The very first treatments for Parkinson's disease were antimuscarinics, not dopamine replacement therapy. And antimuscarinics are very effective in treating the motor symptoms of Parkinson's disease. They're not used clinically very much because of side effects. What I'll try and convince you of is that, in fact, upregulation of acetylcholine release and increased signaling through M1 receptors, which are ubiquitously expressed by medium spine neurons, that they are critical to this loss of cortical connectivity that we see following dopamine depletion. That activation of those receptors selectively upregulates the dendritic excitability of striatopalatal neurons by downregulating an inwardly rectifying potassium channel of the KER2 family. And that leads to enhanced synaptic integration and increased activation of CAV1.3 channels, those calcium channels of the spine head, which makes the cell think it's got too much excitatory input. And we think, as a consequence, homeostatically downregulates the only thing that it can downregulate to diminish its excitability and its activity, its spiking, and that is glutamatergic synapses. Okay, so this is, again, it's too bad Chip's not here because this is just a ripoff of one of Chip's beautiful diagrams in one of his reviews. The structure that I'm going to talk about is the striatum. The striatum gets glutamatergic input from cortex and from thalamus. All medium spiny neurons get inputs from both sources. These cells also get a strong dopaminergic input from the substantia nigra pars compacta. Okay. Now, this is a fill from Paul Bolum's work of a medium spiny neuron. These are the principal neurons of the striatum. 95% or so of the neurons are of this morphological class. And out in the dendrites, you can see the dendrites are very heavily studded with spines. Out in those regions, there's a triadic arrangement formed between cortical terminals, spines, and dopaminergic fibers arising from the substantia nigra pars compacta. They form this beautiful triadic arrangement. This is sort of my cartoon of what's going on there. And it's this unit that we think is critical to the normal function of dopamine as well as the adaptations that follow dopamine depletion. So studies of medium spiny neurons and how they adapt, how they respond to dopamine have really been plagued in years past by the fact that there are two flavors of medium spiny neuron in the striatum. As I said before, there are neurons which contribute to this indirect pathway that synapse primarily in the globus pallidus, and there are other cells which project primarily to the substantia nigra pars reticulata, do not synapse in the external segment of the globus pallidus. These cells express primarily D2 dopamine receptors. These cells express primarily D1 dopamine receptors. So teasing out what dopamine was doing to those cell types requires really, I think, teasing apart those two cell types. And until recently, that was very difficult because morphologically, the cells were indistinguishable. The development of BAC transgenic mice has made this possible and very feasible for electrophysiologists like us. This is just a slice of a brain from a D2 BAC transgenic where D2 receptor expressing cells are labeled with EGFP. You can see these cells project axons just as far as the globus pallidus. In D1 BAC mice, you get this nice, beautiful labeling of medium spiny neurons in the striatum and also labeling of their terminal fields in the substantia nigra pars reticulata. You can do slices, look at the cells. They're nice, fluorescently labeled cells. You can do single-cell profiling to verify that the expression of EGFP is, in fact, properly linked to cell type. And, for example, in the D1 BACs, you can show that those cells express substance P mRNA and D1 receptor mRNA, but do not express D2 receptor mRNA or enkephalin, which is another marker for indirect pathway. In contrast, in D2 BACs, they express enkephalin, but not substance P and D2 receptor mRNA, just as we had expected. Moreover, they look like medium spiny neurons. These are alexophils, I think about a 70 micron Z stack done with 2 photon of a BACD1 medium spiny neuron and a BACD2 medium spiny neuron. They have nice, densely studded dendrites, the right size. They have exactly the right electrophysiological signature. One of the things I'm going to come back to later is these cells all have got very strongly inwardly rectifying potassium currents, which keeps voltage deflections from stepping appropriately when you go in negative membrane potentials. And this regulates synaptic integration in these cells. Okay, so one of the initial questions we set out to ask was just if we look at the cells in the BAC D1 and D2 mice, after dopamine depletion, can we see anything that's obvious? So we're going to eliminate the dopaminergic input. And we've done that in a variety of different ways. We've done 6-hydroxydopamine lesioning. We've done MPTP lesions. The simplest way of doing this is just to do an acute reserpine depletion for 5 days. The animals become Parkinsonian. We've checked to make sure that none of the effects that I'm going to describe today are attributable to depletion of serotonin or noradrenaline, which are also depleted by this pharmacological regimen. And what you see is something very interesting, and this was described early last year in a manuscript in Nature Neuroscience. If you look at D1 cells following 5 days of dopamine depletion, and this doesn't really make any difference whether it's 5 days or 30 days. It does make a difference whether it's 2 days or 30 days. But 5 days and on, these changes are pretty much stable. The D1 cells look pretty normal in terms of dendritic morphology. Spine density, and I hope you can see that, looks pretty normal in these cells. If you look at other measures of synaptic connectivity like minis, glutamatergic minis, mini frequency and amplitude both before and after dopamine depletion is perfectly normal. These cells don't seem to change in any way that's obvious. In contrast, striatopallidal D2 receptor expressing neurons are very markedly changed. First of all, their dendritic tree looks a little dysmorphic. Dendritic length is reduced. And if you look at spine density looks dramatically lower than it is in control D2s. There's no basal difference between D1 and D2 receptor-expressing medium spine neurons, by the way. If you have any questions, raise your hand and holler, stop me. If you look at many frequencies, so not just spines, but if you look at evidence of actual glutamatergic synapses, many frequency is dramatically lower in dopamine-depleted striatopalatal neurons. Okay? Now, this is using cesium-filled internals, so we're maximizing the visibility of EPSCs. And again, I'm going to come back to this because it's been reported that mini frequency actually increases in at least a subpopulation of medium spiny neurons following dopamine depletion. And if you use a potassium-based internal that allows the electrotonic structure of the dendritic tree to factor into what you see, in fact, that's true. And that gives us an important clue about the adaptations that are taking place, at least postsynaptically. But using cesium, so we maximize the visibility of synaptic connections, mini frequency goes down in parallel with a loss of spines and other anatomical markers of glutamatergic synapses. Now, this is just a summary. So if you count spines, for example, right here after the first branch point, control spine density is about 9 spines per 10 microns, and D1 cells is pretty normal, and D2 cells it's down about half, which matches with change in mini frequency. Okay. Now, this isn't just an artifact of our experimental paradigm. This is exactly what you see in Parkinson's disease patients. This is some work done by Stevens et al. It was published a year or so ago, looking at medium spiny neuronal length or dendritic length in normal patients and in Parkinson's patients. And if you look at spine density, it's clearly reduced. So what we're seeing is something that happens in the patient. Okay? What wasn't appreciated from these studies was that this is happening in one subpopulation of medium spiny neurons. Okay, the striatopalatal neurons. So why? What's the mechanism? We know mechanism, we can control it, right? So we had been looking at what L-type calcium channels did, and we had discovered a few things about them that led us to believe that they might be players in this process. Now, medium spiny neurons, there are two types of L-type calcium channel that are expressed in most neurons. CAV1.2 and CAV1.3. CAV1.2 is your typical run-of-the-mill L-type calcium channel. It's also the cardiac isoform of the L-type calcium channel. The typical high-threshold L-type calcium channel. It's only going to get activated by spikes. CAV1.3, on the other hand, is a low-threshold L-type calcium channel, and its pharmacological profile is very similar to CAV3 channels or T-type calcium channels. And so I think in a lot of preparations, it's been confused with CAV3 channels and T-type calcium channels. So medium spiny neurons co-express both of these. Both classes of medium spiny neuron do. This just shows the voltage dependence of the CAV1.3 compared to the CAV1.2. This was done in high barium. So in physiological calcium, CAV1.3 is going to activate much closer to about minus 60, minus 65, right in that sub-threshold voltage range where you're going to get synaptic signals. Okay. Moreover, medium spiny neurons express a particular splice variant of CAV1.3 that has important functional consequences. There are two C-terminal splice variants that are expressed in brain neurons. The distruncated form is the brain-dominant form. This long C-terminal splice variant is rarer. And if you look in medium spiny neurons, they express almost exclusively this long C-terminal splice variant. Many other neurons that we've profiled express the short variant. The long splice variant has got shank interaction domains, which pulls those channels to glutamatergic synapses. And if you do EM, you can see in medium spiny neurons immunoreactivity for CAV1.3 right in the spine head. Here's a glutamatergic synapse. Here's a postsynaptic spine. And you can see this nice immunoreactivity here. Here's another pre-terminal, the spine, and lots of immunoreactivity for CAV1.3 right at the spine head. Okay, so these channels are tuned to voltage changes, small voltage changes, like you might expect to happen with synaptic transmission, and they're positioned right at glutamatergic synapses. Moreover, genetically deleting CAV1.3 channels has clear effects on spine density. So this is a normal medium spiny neuron. We're looking at a little region of the dendrite here, somewhere along secondary dendrites. We have sort of normal spine density. In a CAV1.3 knockout, spine density is dramatically higher, about 50% higher. Mini frequency is also about 50% higher, suggesting that these channels are negative regulators of glutamatergic synapses. Okay? So could they be playing a role in this loss of connectivity we see with dopamine depletion? Well, one of the studies that was done by Ariel Deutsch at Vanderbilt. Ariel did Golgi analysis, and first of all, he reproduced the spine loss that we see with dopamine depletion. He used 6-hydroxydopamine, but again, we see the same thing. He systemically then administered an L-type calcium channel antagonist and redid the spine counts. There was no change. Okay, so this was a clear indication that, in fact, blocking L-type calcium channels could prevent the loss of spines and synapses. We took it one step further. We went back to the CAV1.3 null and looked first in D1 cells following dopamine depletion. And, of course, in these, we're identifying these cells now not by EGFP fluorescence but by single-cell PCR. Substance P-positive cells, marker of D1 cells, there's basically no change in spine density following dopamine depletion, but that we knew that wouldn't happen. More importantly, there's no change in spine density in striatopalatal neurons if you lack CAV1.3 channels, and that's just shown here. These cells, again, don't lose spines following dopamine depletion, suggesting that CAV1.3 channels are absolutely critical to the loss of spines and synapses following dopamine depletion. And this just shows the quantitation, that there's just no significant change following dopamine depletion. So I'm going to go quickly over this. But one question is whether that loss of input is selective. I told you at the beginning that there's cortical input and there's thalamic input. Both inputs are onto spines, although the cortical input is exclusively onto spines. Some of the thalamic input terminates on shafts. And to make a long story short, it basically, what we had to do to sort this issue out was to develop a slice preparation where we could actually stimulate cortex or stimulate thalamus and know we were selectively activating those inputs to medium spiny neurons. So we've been working with a horizontal slice preparation, which is shown here, and we think in this preparation, when we stimulate cortex, we're just activating cortical fibers, and when we stimulate thalamus, we're selectively activating thalamic fibers, because if we do knife cuts here or here, we completely lose our responses. Okay, in contrast to the situation in a coronal slice, which is sort of the model of preference for most people doing striatal physiology. This just shows synaptic responses by cortical and thalamic stimulation in this paradigm. Now, one of the problems in doing this is regulating synaptic stimulus intensity. And so what we've been using as a measure of the extent of cortical activation is the presence of a feed-forward inhibitory circuit through GABAergic parvalbumin interneurons. And if you look at synaptic responses with relatively high internal chloride, you can see when you stimulate cortex, there's a big response. A large part of it is sensitive to gabazine, the blocker of this synaptic input. Okay? The remaining part of it, shown here in red, is blocked by AMPA receptor antagonists. Okay? Now, when we do a dopamine depletion, what happens is this circuit is intact. We can normalize by the amplitude of that component, but the response, the AMPA-sensitive component, is typically gone or dramatically attenuated, suggesting the cortical input to striatopalatal neurons is lost. The thalamic stimulation yields very similar results to what we see in normosensitive, undepleted animals, suggesting that the thalamic input is largely unaffected by this manipulation. So what is it about striatopalatal neurons? I told you that CAV1.3 channels are critical to the pruning, but those channels are expressed by both classes of medium spiny neurons. what is it about striatopal neurons that makes them so sensitive to dopamine depletion? Well, one thing that's been suggested, a recent paper by Rob Malenka and colleagues, is that the glutamatergic inputs to D2 cells are different. And so we set out to try and nail this down. And what, in fact, we see is that there's no difference between D1 and D2 cells in their AMPA-NMDA receptor ratios when you stimulate cortex. So here's an example. These have all been scaled to the amplitude of the AMPA component. And these are identified by APV, antagonism, and then subtraction. But the bottom line is the cortical input has a very low AMPA-NMDA receptor ratio. There's lots of NMDA receptors associated with those cortical inputs, whereas the thalamic input has a much larger AMPA-NMDA receptor ratio. Right, so it looks like to us that when you use intrastriatal stimulation, you preferentially activate one subpopulation of these afferents when you're looking at striatopalatal neurons. But they do not differ in a way that would predict that these cells would lose their synapses following dopamine depletion. And this is just a statistical summary showing that there clearly is a difference in the AMPA-NMDA receptor ratio between cortical and thalamic inputs, to both to D1 and D2 cells. But there's no difference in either of these inputs in their AMPA-NMDA receptor ratio when one particular side is stimulated. If also you look at something like paired pulse ratios to get a measure of release probability, there's a big difference between the cortical and thalamic input that's cell type independent. So the thalamic input is rapidly depressing, whereas the cortical input is facilitating. And that's just shown by changes with paired pulse ratio with interstimulus interval here. Again, this is no different in D2 cells than it is in D1 cells. It just shows the similar profiles for striatonigral neurons here. And striatopalatal neurons have a very similar response, a depressing response to thalamic input. So it's not the afferent inputs, we think, that are any different in those two cell types. That does not explain the pruning. So one other possibility is that there are intrinsic differences that might contribute. And one point of agreement between Rob's work and ours is that do look like, in the slice preparation, there are intrinsic differences in the excitability of D1 and D2 cells. And this is seen most clearly in generating FI curves, where we're just giving step current injections to D1 and D2 cells. And what we see is the D2 cells have lower rebase currents and have leftwardly shifted frequency current plots. So they look more excitable. Now, truth be told, I think this is a reflection of acute dopamine depletion. And I'll show you a little bit later that I think this is exactly what we'd expect if we eliminated D2 receptor tone from the slice. And remember, we're making acute slices and perfusing them and washing away all the dopamine. So I don't think that this actually reflects a difference in the excitability of neurons in situ or in vivo. Okay. We also see a difference in dendritic excitability. And these are some slides that I stuck in here for Dietmar because 2 years ago I stood up and challenged him without any real basis for doing so, just because I'm antagonistic sometimes. And I promised him this data, and in fact, so I think it's important, it's interesting. So what we're doing here is we're filling cells with Alexa and then loading them with a calcium dye, right? And we're evoking a spike in the soma using a current pulse. So what we're interested in are backpropagating action potentials. We're doing a line scan across a spine head and a dendrite and looking for a calcium signal. And in D1 cells, we cannot see signals, calcium signals, beyond the first branch point with this kind of a paradigm. We just don't see anything under normal situations. In D2 cells, the situation is quite different. spikes seem to backpropagate very readily beyond the first branch point. We see very nice calcium signals both in spine head and the shaft of the dendrites. Now, this doesn't address Dietmar's question about what would happen if we depolarize the cells. The backpropagation is certainly enhanced by somatic depolarization, repetitive firing. But with a single backpropagating action potential evoked from minus 80, this is what we see. This is just a sort of a summary of all the experiments that we've done. You can see this is a plot of the change in the calcium signal. It's an indirect measure of the backpropagating action potential. All of those backpropagating action potentials are dependent upon sodium, however, because if you puff TTX onto the proximal dendrite, all this goes away. But the D1 cells are much less excitable. There's much less propagation into the dendritic tree than for the D2 cells. Okay? Suggesting, again, that D2 cells are somehow more excitable in the slice than D1 cells are. Now, we think a big part of this backpropagating action potential is controlled by Kv4.2 channels. I don't know if you can see this very well. This is the green is the back-driven EGFP. And so this is a D2 striatopalatal neuron cultured with cortex so that there are nice spines that develop, and we can do the immuno. The red is immunoreactivity for Kv4.2, and you can see this cell has got it, and if you look out into the dendrites, you can see lots of nice Kv4 immunoreactivity. I'm not going to show you the data, but if you block Kv4 channels with 4-AP, you can get beautiful, big, huge backpropagating calcium signals in both cell types. Now, it may be that the difference we see between D1 and D2 cells is attributable to either expression level of Kv4.2 or modulation of Kv4.2, both of which have been demonstrated in other cell types. And Dax Hoffman has been one of the leaders in characterizing those differences. So are any of those differences linked possibly to D2 receptors? I made this point that loss of D2 receptor tone might be a factor. And again, just want to emphasize that these striatopalatal neurons express D2 receptor mRNA and protein, and D2 receptor stimulation certainly diminishes excitability. If you take a medium spiny neuron and you hold it a little bit positive and inject current to evoke spikes and apply a D2 receptor agonist, you see a diminished spike generation, and this is broad across the current injection spectrum. But you notice that this looks a little bit like the inverse of the curve that I showed you a little bit earlier about the difference between D1 and D2 cells. So in the presence of D2 receptor stimulation, D1 and D2 cells look almost the same. But it does make the point that D2 receptor stimulation diminishes excitability. This extends to the dendrites, so that if you look again at backpropagating action potentials, you can see a nice calcium signal as this BAP moves past this spine. And if you puff on a D2 agonist, you wipe it out. Okay. Again, suggesting D2 receptor stimulation diminishes dendritic excitability, diminishes calcium channel opening in dendrites. We also know that D2 receptor stimulation directly suppresses CAV1.3 channel opening. This is an acutely isolated neuron that's been voltage clamped. We're giving a step depolarization. We're looking at tail currents using BK8644 because we can isolate L-type calcium channels that way from all the other calcium channels that are contributing to this response to depolarization. And we know that application of D2 receptor agonists diminishes the L-type calcium channel currents. We know the signaling pathway. We know that this is selective for CAV1.3. So all of that fits, I'm going to skip past this, all of that fits into this sort of general model. The dopamine depletion decreases D2 receptor activity, which increases CAV1.3, and I haven't shown you the data, but also sodium channel function. D2 receptors downregulate sodium channels through a pKa-dependent mechanism that enhances Sloan activation. That increases dendritic excitability. I've shown you is that D2 receptor stimulation decreases dendritic excitability. The loss of that tone should increase excitability, which should lead to further opening of CAV1.3 channels. Those are depolarization-activated channels, which we think triggers spine collapse and synapse elimination. We've also looked at whether or not endocannabinoid production might be a factor, because D2 receptors have been linked to endocannabinoid production. We know that loss of endocannabinoid tone could increase through presynaptic mechanism glutamate release, which might also increase dendritic excitability. But incubation with AM251, administration with reserpine, has no effect on spine loss. So we don't think that that's a key factor. All right. Are there other things that are involved? Well, why isn't this story enough? Why isn't dopamine enough? All of the channels that I've talked about so far are active in this depolarized voltage range, sodium channels, CV1.3 channels. Medium spiny neurons don't spend very much time there. Medium spiny neurons are engineered to sit very close to the potassium equilibrium potential. And in response to coherent excitatory glutamatergic input from either cortex or thalamus, they depolarize and move into this up state, what's called an up state. This is called a down state. Right? And it's here that these channels get activated. So loss of D2 receptor tone might enhance upstate excitability, but they certainly aren't going to affect anything down here and won't affect the probability that an upstate transition occurs, at least not by any mechanism that we know. So does something happen down here? The first clue that we had that, in fact, something was happening down there came from studies looking at minis. And I told you at the beginning that when you use cesium to eliminate basically the electrotonic structure of medium spiny neurons, what happens when you dopamine deplete is that mini frequency drops. But the control mini frequency that you see in cesium-loaded cells is 4 or 5 times higher than it is if you use a potassium-based internal, which basically allows the electrotonic structure of the dendrite to influence what you see. Basically, what it means is that synapses that are out on the distal dendrites, when you use a potassium-based internal, you don't see. They're so attenuated that they're in the noise. When you use cesium, you make the cell electrotonically compact and increase the visibility of those inputs. Now, if you use a potassium-based internal and you look at D1 cells following dopamine depletion, there's no change in mini frequency. You see the mini frequency is down here, not up here, as it was with cesium. In contrast, if you look at D2 cells following dopamine depletion, there's a nice increase in mini frequency. But again, only with potassium-based internals, suggesting that what's happening with dopamine depletion is that synapses that are invisible to you because of electrotonic properties of the cell now become visible following dopamine depletion. Okay. So what is it that governs the electrotonic structure of medium spiny neurons? The structure of electrotonic structure of medium spiny neurons at rest is governed by KER2 channels. These are inwardly rectifying potassium channels, which richly invest the dendrites of medium spiny neurons. And you see them in evidence of them in current voltage plots like this one, where you inject hyperpolarizing current, and the more, even though these are equal amplitude steps, you produce less and less of a voltage change the same size step, because the cell's opening up and becoming leakier and leakier and leakier, that current's all being bled across the membrane. In voltage clamp, you see, again, with equal amplitude voltage steps, small little current deflections. It doesn't take very much current to produce that voltage change. And then as you get to more hyperpolarized potentials, it takes lots and lots of current to move the membrane potential more negative, again, suggesting there's a channel which is opening in these voltages in medium spiny neurons. If you do a current voltage plot and you subtract out a linear leak part that's due to KCNK channels, you see that the red is the current voltage plot of these KER2 channels. So it reverses right at the potassium equilibrium potential. They're very potassium selective. And as the membrane potential depolarizes, these channels close as polyamines and magnesium are swept up into the pore when the current becomes outward. Okay? So they're smart potassium channels in a sense, and they allow that up and down state behavior of medium spiny neurons. They oppose depolarization close to the potassium equilibrium potential, but as those synaptic inputs become stronger, they quit, they close. They let the cell pop up to the up state, let it sit there. They don't fight the cell to try and pull it back down to the potassium equilibrium potential. So KRT2 channels are not modulated by dopamine, at least as best we can tell. They are modulated by acetylcholine. There were a couple reports in the literature that that's true. Moreover, you know, what about acetylcholine? At the beginning, I told you that clinicians have known since the beginning of time that acetylcholine was critical to function of the striatum. As a matter of fact, their clinical observations led them to construct this sort of a circuit diagram in the early 80s, where all the effects of dopamine were mediated by cholinergic cells. And this is all based upon the observation that when you lesioned these cells, you could treat Parkinsonian symptoms by antagonizing this synapse. Now, we know that this isn't true, that these large, giant cholinergic cells are part of a more detailed network in the striatum, and there's direct dopaminergic input to medium spiny neurons, but these cells are still very important players in striatal circuitry. They make synaptic connections with all types of medium spiny neurons, both direct and indirect pathway neurons. They do so, well, let me back up. I stuck these slides in. This is, those cholinergic cells are exquisitely sensitive to thalamic input. And this is an example of this. These are paired recordings from a cholinergic cell colorized in a medium spiny neuron when we're stimulating thalamus or cortex. And I thought I'd throw this in because this has circuit implications for what I'm going to show you a little bit later. This is just a signal, electrophysiological signature of the medium spiny neuron, the electrophysiological signature of the cholinergic cell. These cholinergic cells are autonomously active, but they also respond to glutamatergic synaptic input. If you stimulate cortex here and record from these two cells, there's this beautiful facilitating input, as I showed you before, in the medium spiny neurons, and that's plotted here. There's a much weaker but still facilitating response in the cholinergic interneurons, and this is all normalized to the amplitude of the first EPSC in the striatal neuron. So it facilitates too, but it's a much smaller, weaker input. In contrast, exactly the opposite is true when you stimulate thalamus. Now we're stimulating thalamus, recording from these two cell types. The response in the medium spiny neuron is very rapidly depressing, which is shown here, and the response in the cholinergic cell is very rapidly facilitating. So if those cells would be very well tuned to repetitive activity in thalamus. All right. And I'll come back to that in a few minutes. Now, the postsynaptic effects of those cholinergic cells on the medium spiny neurons are mediated by two muscarinic receptors. M1 receptors are expressed by both types of medium spiny neuron. M4 receptors are expressed by both types, but at much higher levels in striatonigral neurons. But the principal receptor is the M1 receptor. So the question is, could acetylcholine be playing a role in this adaptation? When you do dopamine depletion, acetylcholinergic interneurons increase their release of acetylcholine in the striatum. And again, that leads to the symptoms that everyone knows are associated with Parkinson's disease. So the first thing we did was we looked at D1 and D2 cells and looked at whether or not acetylcholine through the M1 receptor modulated the KRT channels. And here we're doing these are experiments in slices where we're holding positive, giving a negative step, and evoking inwardly rectifying current, applying muscarin, and there's a very clear, about a 50% reduction in this current in D2 cells. And if you apply barium, which is a blocker of these KRTs, you can eliminate the rest of the KRT current. What's left is KCNK channel current. What we were shocked by is the fact that in striatonigral neurons, there's virtually no effect of acetylcholine on the KRT2 channels. This is, again, a D1 cell. It's been identified with single-cell RT-PCR, not with a BAC technology. And this just summarizes over a lot of cells, the modulation of the curves in striatonigral neurons is like less than 10%, whereas it's 50 or 60% or more in striatopalatal neurons. Well, why? Both cell types express M1 receptors. Moreover, if you look at modulation of another potassium channel, which is dependent upon PIP2, KCNQs, the modulation of the KCNQs is indistinguishable in striatonigral and striatopalatal neurons. And if you look at the statistical summary, percent modulation is about 80% in both, suggesting that receptors and signaling cascades are not different in the two cell types. Well, why is there a difference? There are three subunits which contribute to the KIR2 channels, KIR2.1, 2.2, and 2.3. There is a 2.4, but it's not expressed significantly in striatum. KIR2.1 is very difficult to modulate by GPCR activation of phospholipase C and membrane depletion of PIP2. KIR2.3, on the other hand, it has a much lower affinity for PIP2, readily gives it up, and is much easier modulated by G-protein-coupled receptors. KIR2.3 subunits, and these are serial dilution, single-cell profiles. So what we're doing here is we're looking at the abundance of a particular mRNA, of 2.3 mRNA in striatonigral neurons or striatopalatal neurons. The strategy here is pretty straightforward. We just cut the amount of cDNA we get from a single cell in half and half and half and half and half until we lose our PCR signal. We see we lose the signal in striatonigral neurons at least one dilution before we lose it in striatopalatal neurons. And if you look at a big population of cells, it looks as though KIR2.3 mRNA is at least twice as abundant in striatopalatal neurons as it is in striatonigral neurons, suggesting that KIR2.3 channels are more abundant in those cells. That is, the readily modulated KIR channel is more abundant. If you do corticostriatal co-cultures where you get nice spine morphology in medium spiny neurons, and look at immunoreactivity for KIR2.1, you can see 2.1 there. It is there. It's along the shafts. Where is KIR2.3? Right at the spine heads. It's perfectly positioned to regulate synaptic input in D2 cells. Moreover, the modulation we see in striatopalatal neurons of the KIR2.3 channels is disrupted by disrupting an interaction between a C-terminal domain of KIR2.3 and a synaptic anchoring domain, a PDZ domain. And this just shows when we dialyze cells with a peptide that competes off this interaction domain, detargeting the KIR2.3 channels, we lose the ability of M1 receptors to modulate channel currents. All right, that's all fine and dandy, but what does this mean for synaptic transmission? Okay, so the one problem in the striatum is that they're presynaptic muscarinic receptors. So the first way we did this was to puff on glutamate, to bypass the presynaptic element. When you do this in striatonigral neurons, you can see a nice summation of postsynaptic depolarizations. When you put on muscarin, it doesn't do anything. Doesn't change the postsynaptic response at all. The KIR channels are there, because if you block them with barium, you see a nice big enhancement of synaptic summation. In contrast, if you do the same experiment in striatopalatal neurons, you see that here's the control summation. You put on muscarin, you see this beautiful enhancement of the summation, which is about 50% of what you would get with complete channel block. It fits perfectly with what I showed you earlier with the modulation. But does it work with synaptic transmission? Now what we've done is we've incubated the slice in the presence of M2 receptor antagonists that block the presynaptic inhibition. Looking in striatonigral neurons, again, there's no effect on the postsynaptic response to repetitive activation of glutamatergic input to the striatonigral neurons. In contrast, there's a very nice increase in the summation of the postsynaptic response in striatopalatal neurons. Now, this summation works also with the sort of network activation that I showed you earlier. So what we're doing now is we're stimulating thalamus and then testing for postsynaptic responsiveness by stimulating cortex. So here's our control cortical response. Okay, we're stimulating cortex here, but when we condition by stimulating thalamus, which I showed you preferentially activates the cholinergic cells, there's a depression with very short interconditioning delays. You can see the first PSP is reduced by this much, but summation is still enhanced. And if you wait, and for those of you who are basal ganglia aficionados, this waiting period is critical to associative learning paradigms. If you wait 500 to 1,000 milliseconds between the two, the presynaptic effect is gone, and all you have now is this enhancement of postsynaptic integration mediated by M1 receptor activation or suppression of the KER2 channels. And this is just summarized here. All right. So if so, our model is that this cholinergic elevation and dendritic excitabilities could potentially synergize with what I showed you earlier, the loss of inhibitory D2 receptor tone, to engage homeostatic mechanisms. But if that's true, and the cholinergic input, this stuff that I've shown you in the last third, is really important, then if we cut that off, we should affect the spine loss. If we eliminate M1 receptor stimulation. So we did dopamine depletions in M1 receptor knockouts that have been crossed with the BACs so that we knew, could identify D1 and D2 cells. Here is a control M1 D2 cell with fairly normal spine density. And here is a D2 M1 knockout after 5 days of dopamine depletion. Bottom line is there's no change in dendritic morphology. There's no change in spine density. So summarized here, here's our control spine density. We expect spine density in the D2s to change all the way down to here following dopamine depletion. But there's no change if you genetically delete the M1 receptor, suggesting that the M1 receptor-mediated enhancement of dendritic excitability that comes as a consequence of downregulation of dendritic KER channels, KER 2.3 in particular, which is positioned right at the spine head, is absolutely critical to the pruning of spines and synapses following dopamine depletion. So we can summarize by saying, in addition to this pathway, which I showed you before, the dopamine depletion increases acetylcholine release, increases M1 receptor activity, downregulating KER2 channels, enhancing dendritic excitability even further, and further augmenting CAV1.3 channel opening and spine collapse. Okay, so let me stop. Let me summarize very quickly. I tried to convince you that dopamine depletion leads to a rapid and cell-type-specific loss of glutamatergic synapses, again, just in striatopalatal neurons, not in neighboring striatonigral neurons. A pruning is dependent upon a synaptically positioned L-type calcium channel, a CAV1.3 channel, that increased CAV1.3 channel opening is attributable in part to diminished D2 receptor signaling, but it is also attributable to elevations in dendritic excitability that come as a consequence of increased acetylcholine release and increased dendritic excitability, which, again, selectively targets striatopalatal neurons in the striatum. Okay, so let me tell you, who actually did all this work? Michelle Day did almost all the two-photon laser scanning microscopy that I showed you. Wei-Xing Shen did all the muscarinic receptor work. Jun Ding did some of the spine counts and the interneuron work. Enrico Mugnani and David Wilkosin, we're sequencing here. Well, let me just stop there. Let me just tell you. David Wilkosin and Phil Hochberger were critical to bringing up the two-photon laser scanning microscopy at our place. A lot of the work that I showed you was done in collaboration with Ariel Deutsch at Vanderbilt. Susan Cisak and Gordon Arbuthnot verified all of the 2P work that we did using serial section EM in 6-hydroxydopamine lesioned animals. Paul Greengard and Ed Hines gave us the back mice, and none of this work would have been possible without support of NINDS and the Picower Foundation. So thank you for your attention. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Please try to use the microphones for questions.
I certainly might have missed this, but could you recover the glutamatergic inputs in the dopamine-depleted slices by acute application of dopamine?
So it's a great question, and you didn't miss it. Acute application of dopamine doesn't restore the spines and synapses. It takes at least a minimum of 5 days to produce the spine loss, but the real question is, if you give L-DOPA, for example, to a 6-hydroxydopamine lesioned animal, will the spines come back? And I think it's an extremely important question. It has a lot of implications for the development of dyskinesias and things like that, because you think, how in the world would it get wired up again, right? Would the connections be appropriate? It's something that we're in the process of looking at right now. We just don't know. It's a great question.
Sorry. So it seems that either mechanism, blocking either mechanism, rescues the loss of the, so it's either or, right? Do these mice, the depleted mice, either the CAV1.3 or the M1 knockouts, do they move? Or is the loss of the spines a homeostatic consequence trying to compensate for what's absent?
So the CAV1.3 knockouts, we've studied the most, they have no motor deficits. So, but see, they have more spines than...
No, right? They're depleted.
So following dopamine depletion. So, yeah. The way that we have to do that experiment is to do 6-hydroxydopamine lesions because of the impact of reserpine on the animals. And whether there's motor sparing... is a really important question, and it's one that I don't have a good answer for, because we need to do those experiments in both. The second half of the talk is unpublished data, right? So we need to do those experiments in with 6-hydroxy unilateral 6-hydroxydopamine lesions and look to see what the motor capacities of those animals are. I mean, I'll predict that this is maladaptive, that the loss of spines and synapses is maladaptive, but I could be wrong. It could be that that if you maintain spine density and excitability, those cells will die. But I don't know.
Is there any clinical epidemiological evidence that early treatment with muscarinic antagonists plus potentially calcium antagonists used for some other purpose slow the progression of the disease?
There really has not been much data generated on disease progression. As a matter of fact, we're just now coming to some sort of consensus about whether L-DOPA treatment affects the progression of the disease. And there were a lot of people who felt as though L-DOPA should accelerate the progression of the disease, and it doesn't, which addresses an issue that's... I think it's near and dear to my heart, because I don't think dopamine is the toxic factor in Parkinson's disease. The bottom line is there is data suggesting that people treated for hypertension with dihydropyridines, right, actually have a lower incidence of Parkinson's disease than people treated for hypertension with beta blockers. Okay? Now, there is this effect that we know happens with systemic dihydropyridine administration. But actually, I don't think the effect on incidence of Parkinson's disease has anything to do with that. I think, and we have a paper coming out soon, I hope, showing that L-type calcium channels also are a critical factor in the actual pathogenesis of Parkinson's disease, that in fact they are what make dopaminergic neurons in the pars compacta vulnerable to toxins associated with the disease. So there's a bit of a confound in those experiments, as it were. I think that we can get around that with the knockouts, and it's something that we definitely want to do. And so for any of you who are going to sit on study section and look at my competitive renewal, it's really important.
I like the idea that you have two pathways that basically increase the excitability of the two medium spinal neurons. The one would be the CAV1.2, and the other one would be the M1 through the cholinergic interneuron. So one question I have is there a CAV1.2 in a cholinergic interneuron? So are your experiments where you modulate the CAV1.2 in the system is indirectly affecting the muscarinergic tone, which then gives you the main effect of the homeostatic breaking down?
CAV1.3 channels are broadly expressed. So the question is, I do not think, so pacemaking in cholinergic cells is not dependent upon CAV1.3 channels or CAV1.2 channels. It's sodium HCN dependent. Moreover, release of acetylcholine is not dependent upon L-type calcium channels. But truth be told, we have not taken CAV1.3 strida and done, for example, HPALC work to look at acetylcholine levels. And I think that that's a reasonable thing to do. The thing that makes me think, though, that it's not a factor is that the associative learning mechanisms in the CAV1.3 knockout seem perfectly normal. So if we put them through both place learning and habit learning tasks, they're fine. The motor behavior is perfectly fine. They're running every bit as fast as wild-type controls. So I think it's a great question and something I guess I have to think about to see if, in fact, there is some... Because what we would expect is that that there would be diminished basal levels of acetylcholine in the CAV1.3 knockout. And I don't know. We'll look. Well, thank you so much.